And I was thinking about the Sermon on the Mount. And while I was sitting there huffing and puffing, not going that fast, but going at an angle, I thought, you know what? There's a lot of stuff that takes place on people going up a mountain in the Bible. You know what's not easy? Going up a mountain or going up a treadmill, whatever the case may be. So I begin to think about the idea of what it really meant for someone to go up a mountain to meet God. And I want to begin our sermon with this particular verse that I love so much. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 8, thankfully Paul said these words, "Bodily training is of some value. Godliness is of value in every way as it holds the promise of the present life and also the life to come." So Paul said, don't worry about working out too hard. Just make sure you live a good Christian life, basically, is what Paul says. So that gives me some comfort knowing that going up an incline for a very low speed is not that big of a deal in the big picture. But in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 1, with the beginning of the so-called Sermon on the Mount from Jesus, it begins this way. "Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he had sat down, his disciples came to him." So he climbed up the mount, if you will, to preach the so-called Sermon on the Mount. Thus, the title is kind of fitting. But that really is an echo of what was said about Moses originally in the book of Exodus chapter 19 and verse 20. "The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up." And so the idea of God coming down on a mountain and speaking to the people, first you have Moses climbing Mount Sinai to get to the Lord to receive the law of Moses. And then you have Christ himself, God in the flesh, on the mountaintop here, preaching in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the so-called Sermon on the Mount. And there are a lot of different mountains in the Bible that people go up to reach God. Of course, you have Mount Sinai for Moses. You have Mount Zion, if you will, in Jerusalem, where the temple of God was. You have, again, the Sermon on the Mount. You have the Mountain of Transfiguration that Jesus went up with his three best disciples, his best friends, and they perceived the Lord was spiritual in nature. And so all these mountains, people climbing up and down like it's nothing, and there's no verse about them being exhausted when they reached the top. I think I've mentioned a couple of times that for my bachelor party, my preacher's brother Jake and I hiked the Appalachian Trail, and we brought one bottle of water with us each. So we hiked for like 4 or 5 hours up the side of this mountain in Northern Virginia. And we got to the top of the mountain and we're like, okay, let's check the map and see where the freshwater spring is around here. And the answer was not at the top of the mountain, because we were really intelligent people. So we had to hike down the mountain to get the water and hike back up to camp. So that was, again, a learning experience. So you learn that hiking up a mountain is no easy feat. And so all these people hiking up these mountains to meet with God, to commune with him, to learn from him, is not an easy thing. So as I am on this treadmill, out of breath, thinking about hiking up a mountain to meet God, this concept kind of came to me. That's the origin of this thought. And I want to look at one particular facet of one particular individual who went through some training to be able to reach the top of the mountain without being out of breath in a spiritual and physical sense. And that man's Moses. Let's look over in the book of Exodus chapter 2. I want to examine three particular areas of his life where God was training him to climb that mountain. So Exodus chapter 2 and verse 1, let's talk about his childhood. "Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds in the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young women walked beside her, beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. Because of course the baby's crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to come and nurse the child for you?" The Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." The girl went and called the child's mother. So Moses is the child here in this context, and the mother is the mother of Moses here. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take the child away, nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." So here is the origin story, if you will, of the childhood of Moses. We don't have a lot of detail here about a lot of the things that we're curious about, naturally. What we do see here is that Moses' mother is kind. She's full of love. She's full of mercy. But she's also very clever. That's very, very interesting here in this context because Moses had to learn how to be clever to live in this world. So we don't really see anything else from the life of Moses from his birth at this point in time, 3 months old, until he's 40 years old in verse 11. And so his childhood is a mystery to us. But knowing what we hear in verse 11, that he recognized himself to be a Hebrew, and the Hebrew people were his people. He grew up in Pharaoh's household with that education, with that level of luxury, if you will. But he resonated with his own kin, with his own tribe, his own people, the Hebrews that were here as slaves one generation later, when we look into the context. And so, knowing little about his childhood, though, we see that he grew up in a household that told him who he was. In a similar kind of way, Paul the Apostle in the New Testament had an apprentice. He had a young protege named Timothy. And a similar kind of idea is expressed there in the book of 2 Timothy chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. Paul said this, "As I remember your tears, I long to see you, that I may be filled with joy." So they departed from each other for a while. There was some sorrow at that parting. And then verse 5, "I am reminded of your sincere faith, a faith that dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and now I am sure dwells in you as well." And so when looking at the life of Moses, we don't have the detail we wish we had about his childhood. But we can gather from his life, his choices, his words, that he grew up in a household where he was taught about who God was, who his people were, and to not get distracted by the luxury of the Egyptian household. So what prepared Moses to be able to eventually climb that mountain and meet with God? Well, his childhood was a good start. Next, his experiences. Over in chapter 2 and verse 11, "One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens," because they were slaves. "And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. He said to the one man in the wrong, 'Why do you strike your companion?' And he answered, 'Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?' And Moses was afraid and thought, 'Surely the thing is known.' When Pharaoh heard it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh. He stayed in the land of Midian. And then he sat down by a well." So the first major event of his adult life, him trying to, it would seem, free his own people from slavery by his own actions. Him killing an Egyptian, hiding the body, trying to be an arbiter, be a mediator between these two kinsmen that were fighting. He seems like he's trying to step up and do the right thing. And yet this fear that he has of being killed by Pharaoh is a huge de-incentivizer. He decides to run and to flee for his life. The next thing we find him doing is sitting down by the well. In verse 16, "Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. So they were tending the sheep of their father. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. Now, he's on the run for his life. He's fleeing Pharaoh, fleeing Egypt. He's now in Midian. He's sitting down by a well, no doubt exhausted, but he still has enough courage to stand up to some shepherds and to help these women that are there tending their father's flock. In verse 18, when they came home to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come home so early today?" And he said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may have bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son. He called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." So at age 40, he tries to deliver his people from bondage. It goes terrible, and he has to flee for his life. He goes, sits down by a well, and instead of delivering his own people, he delivers the shepherd daughters and helps them in this situation to water the flocks. And then from that action, he gains a father-in-law, a wife, and then later a son. And I got to tell you, before when I read this passage, like, okay, well, he lived a little bit. But obviously, having a father-in-law, having a wife, having a child makes you grow a little bit, right? To say the least. You gain some experience in life if you've never had those things before. And so we look at the childhood of Moses, all that which prepared him to become the man who could climb the mountain without being out of breath. And the first step was his childhood. It was a childhood, no doubt, of some privilege, but also of him knowing that he was a stranger in Pharaoh's household, knowing that he was a Hebrew, that he was trying to be killed, trying to be slaughtered as a child, but his mother's cunning saved him in this situation. That was a good impression that she left him with at the very least. Secondly, he tried to deliver his people, but he couldn't. He then tried to protect the shepherd's daughters and got a wife out of the deal and a son out of the deal. And most importantly, probably in this text, a new job out of that deal. He was just Moses, and now he is the son-in-law of Jethro, the priest of Midian. He's now a shepherd. So he's taking care of the flock that belongs to his father-in-law. And that prepared him for the next task that he had before him. Over in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 1, we had his childhood, his experiences, and now finally his calling. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Oreb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. Is it Jane? It's Jane. All right, I'm going to start keeping a tally up here of how many times I say, "Let's read," and somebody else tries to read it for me. Okay. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. Now, small little thing here. This would catch my attention, too. Back in Gloucester, where I grew up, it was kind of the country away from the city of the east side of Virginia. And we had burn pits. You all got burn pits out here? Got burn barrels? You have that some places? Okay, you got a big old 55-gallon drum steel barrel. Poke some holes in that guy for some airflow. You throw your stuff in there, you burn it. That's how you get rid of garbage and how you get rid of a brush and so on. Not plastic. I'd never burn plastic, you know me. But, you know, brush, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, you pour enough gasoline on some brush and you light it, after the explosion that happens inevitably, the stuff burns and is consumed. And so if you've got a great raging fire coming out of a bush, I go, all right, it's going to be over pretty quickly. But it was not. It kept going. So that kind of got his attention. He said, verse 3, "I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned." When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, he said, here I am. He says, do not come near. Take your sandals off of your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. So he was on the mountainside, if you will. He saw the burning bush that was not consumed. God called to him from the midst of this burning bush and called him to be the savior of the people, to be the one that was sent back to his previous land of failings, Egypt, to finally redeem his people, not by his own power or might or cunning or works, but by the might and the power of God. That was the calling for him to go back and do what he was trying to do before, but do it now alongside of the power of God. And that's what gave Moses the ability to eventually lead the people away from bondage, away from slavery, to be delivered through the Red Sea, their water passage, if you will, and then go on to eventually, one generation later, the promised land of Canaan. Now, there's a text here that we see him growing. In this particular passage of Exodus chapter 3 and verse 1 through 6 and following, we see him making excuse after excuse after excuse as to why he was not the right guy for this job. And if you just knew his side of the story, you would agree with him. You would say, yeah, you're right. You tried before, you failed, and now you're out here for 40 years being a shepherd. You're not the guy. The first 40 years of his life in Pharaoh's household. The second 40 years of his life, a shepherd in the wilderness of Midian. And in the last 40 years, he was the shepherd of God's people, Israel, that God delivered from Egyptian bondage. That's how his life is segmented. And so at this point in time, he's not yet the guy who's to be the mediator for the people. But he's been brought to that point. Let's jump forward here into Exodus chapter 24, which is a huge jump, I know. Let's pick up in Exodus 24 in verse 9. Long story short, the people leave Egypt dramatically, you might say. They get to the mountainside where God's presence was. Moses goes up, communes with God, comes back down. Things are going awry. There's some correction going on. There's some covenants being made. And now the people have tried to commune with God on the side of the mountain, but they're terrified of his presence. There's lightning and thundering flashes that they cannot take that kind of scene from God to be in his presence. So now they're taking a smaller, select group of people from the leadership, and they're going up and communing with God because the people can't take it. And so in verse 9, Exodus 24 and verse 9, then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven, for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God, and they ate and they drank. The Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. So Moses rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up into the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Behold, whoever has a dispute, let him go to them. Then Moses went up the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people. Moses entered the cloud and went up into the mountain, and he was there for 40 days and 40 nights. An incredible scene here, if you imagine what that must have been like. For them to go up basically halfway the mountain, to be called by God, for Moses to climb the rest and to be there for 40 days and to 40 nights, and to not know how this man's able to take being in the presence of God himself on that mountaintop. But the most incredible part to me is the fact that when you look at this man, Moses, here in this text, he is a completely different person than he was the last time he communed with God on the mountaintop. When he met the Lord in chapter 3, he gave excuse after excuse after excuse as to why he wasn't the person. But in this context, he was the only person who could go up the rest of the way, commune with God, and get the covenant of the law of Moses and connect the people to God himself. And maybe most importantly, he wasn't out of breath, if you will. He was the right kind of person who had been through the right kind of training and conditioning, not by physical exertion, but by his experiences in life, to be the kind of person who could go up and commune with God. Now, here is the point of all this. I'm not saying that you should be on a treadmill every single day. Maybe it couldn't hurt. I don't know. But the real point is, you are in training. You are being conditioned. You have been conditioned. What I mean is the fact that God has, through your life, given you the experiences to make you who you are at this very moment. He's made you the kind of person through life experience that's able to climb that mountaintop and commune with God. Not in the same way that Moses did here in this text, but to climb the mountain of life to experience his covenant through the very scriptures we're reading at this moment. So physically, do we need to be in shape to meet with God? Well, not really. But spiritually, if we look at our life, we've been training to meet with God on the mountaintop of life and ultimately heaven our entire lives. And to commune with him is no small feat. And if we understand that and we realize that, we won't be out of breath either when we finally commune with him in the full sense. And so the entire point for us this morning is the fact that when we look at our life, like the life of Moses, he had events in his life that shaped who he was. And through his experiences, he was the kind of person God needed him to be at that point in time in history. The same thing is true about each and every one of us. We all have the same kind of soul that Moses had. We have different lives, but we all are being shaped by God to be the kind of person he needs us to be if we're willing to climb that mountain before us. So this morning, if you have a need to respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ, your life has led to that moment. Your life has been leading you to the saving power of the Lamb of God. If you are a Christian and you have been climbing that mountain, but you're winded, you're tired, you're aching, allow us to help you up the mountain. If we can pray for you this morning, encourage you in any kind of way, respond by coming forward now as we stand and we sing.